The biggest names in tennis are coming to Paris for the most anticipated Roland Garros in years. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled tournament access as the world's top players in tennis face off against each other. Will the veteran champions continue their dominance, or will a fresh face emerge to challenge their legacy on the clay courts? Daily live coverage of this epic showdown begins Monday, May 20th. Don't miss a matchup. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
So welcome to another episode of the Science of Sport podcast with myself, Mike Finch, and Professor Ross Tucker. And we've been offline for a while because Ross has been traveling around Portugal for a while on a bike trip. I think that looked quite a lot of fun, a lot of mileage and a lot of climbing done in that, 5 days?
Yeah, I wouldn't have...
It was a race, wasn't it?
Oh, no, heavens, no. I don't do the racing thing.
It was a ride.
It was a tour. So basically the easy way, right? They take your bags ahead to the next stop. You cycle there. So 5 days, 760K I ended up doing. 174 was the longest and 118 the shortest. And Portugal's a gem for cycling. I would not have made a list of 10 places I wanted to cycle in and have Portugal on that list. But now that I've done it, I'd recommend it.
What are the roads like? Are they nice and smooth?
Yeah, mostly. There's some where it's sort of back roads and you can see they haven't been done for a number of years and there's a lot of cracks and holes and so on. But for the most part, really good and quiet. By the time we got to the end, we finished on the Thursday. I went for another ride on the Saturday because one of our patrons and listeners recommended that I do this Mount Foya, which is where the Algarve, the Tour of the Algarve finishes every year. Yes. It's like the highest climb in Algarve. So I said, off I go and I'm going to do this thing. And I realized that I'd gotten so lazy from never seeing a car that I was running stoplights and traffic circles and I had to rein myself in and say, hang on, you're not the only thing on the roads, because for 5 days, that's what we were just about. It was really wonderful.
The problem with that is when you do come back to civilization and reality, it's a bit of a shock, isn't it?
No, I went the other day and I thought I was in a death match about 1,000 cars. That was dreadful. Horrendous. I'm going to have to go back then, right?
I think for those of you who follow Ross and Strava, you would have noticed how bad a ride that was, because I think he even commented on your Strava that it was cars and traffic lights.
Cars and wind and just...
You've been spoiled.
So I have been. It's ruined me. And I was in Switzerland before that, which is even better.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. It's
beautiful places to ride.
I could not think of a better place to cycle.
So a lot's happened in the last couple of weeks. A marathon world record in Berlin with Eliud Kipchoge. I mean, that was... unbelievable. 30 seconds, which doesn't sound like a lot over a marathon, but it is a significant drop, and was touching on the sub 201 mark at one point.
Well, sub two. Down,
sub, well, yeah,
he
sub
was,
two.
It was 59.51 at halfway.
That's right. And he slowed, I think, from the 38th K to the 40th K, he slowed a bit. I think his slowest K was at 39 kilometers, which was a 3:12.
Well,
otherwise, he was running 2:51s.
You have to pay. I mean, you can't. Yeah. The guy who was with him, because he wasn't alone, which is even more amazing at halfway at 59.50 pace, the guy who was with him ran 2:06. So that's a 66-something second half. That's what you expect. But Kipchoge what was it, 59.51 and then a 61.18, which is 2:02.36. And only him and Bekele have ever done faster than that pace for a marathon. So, I mean, he went too fast in the first half and still ran one of the fastest second halves. It's unbelievable.
So he didn't really blow.
No.
You can't blow when you're running that fast for the second half.
No, but it does. I think it does show you that you can go out at 59.59 and at the moment the sub 2 is just not going to happen. You know, people can say, if he'd run 2:01.09 even split, you know, 60-30, people would say, that's quite close. But he gave it a shot, and he was actually, in the end, you know, if 30 seconds is a big improvement on the world record, which it is, then 69 off 2 is a lot. It's not going to happen soon. And the other thing to remember is that, and I can't believe he's still doing it, because he's 37 officially. You think surely time's going to catch up. No one, incidentally, in the top 100 has run a PB at 37. It's the first. Bekele's the only other guy, and he was a couple hundred days older. Kipchoge turns 38, I think, next month, actually, in November. So I can't I mean, I thought this before Sunday. I can't see Kipchoge continuing to break records.
Yeah, but I think a lot of people have said that, haven't they?
Well, including me before this. I thought for sure 2019 would be the point at which he would have peaked and then start dropping off. But he's defying age. You think, well, okay, shoes. Yeah. I can't see them making a shoe 30 seconds better than the 2018 version. Maybe they have. I don't know. That's the problem with the shoes again. But we don't want to turn over that soil again. But yeah, I mean, just unbelievable performance. And I was surprised that it happened. I didn't watch it because it was the first day of the cycling trip. But every stop, every chance I got, I was checking Twitter to see what was happening. And it's just, it's beyond belief.
Watching him bounce, I mean, just visually watching him sort of bouncing along in those shoes is quite remarkable. I mean, you can literally see, having watched the marathons in the last 10 years, you can visibly see the effect of the shoes in the way that he almost bounces off the road when you see him running at that pace. So that's quite remarkable.
And the metronomic. Woman, and the woman also has a 2:15 from an 800-meter runner back in her former life.
Mm.
And women's running has also, I mean, everything has been changed by the shoe, you know. So, again, we've spoken often about recalibration required. But again, this is the same guy. So then you look at the list now and he's 32 seconds faster than Bekele, and the next guy's another minute back.
Yeah.
So he's so much better than anyone else.
Bekele won the master section at London Marathon.
Yeah. That was an over 40s world record.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So I don't know. There's a podcast in aging and performance and how, you know, these days you can have a conversation about how young these endurance champions are in cycling, and you can have a conversation about how old they are.
Yeah.
And it's like the rule book that I remember, you know, mid to late 20s you peak and you're done by early 30. No way, that's not the case anymore. So that's pretty interesting as well. There's probably a handful of reasons
for that. So that sort of magic spot where we talk about the prime of your athletic career has almost got wider.
Mm.
We see it in cycling. We've got Valverde and Pogacar on the one side and Valverde on the other. You know, it's just remarkable how they're able to extend their careers. But I suppose that's science and training to some extent, isn't
it? To some extent, that'll be part of it. Mm. A mate of mine jokingly and quite astutely said, Kipchoge must be unhappy that the shoes only came along when he was 34.
Yes.
If he'd had those shoes at a 24-year-old, I wonder how fast he'd have been.
Well, in fact, I actually interviewed Haile Gebrselassie when I went to Germany a couple of months ago, and I asked him, how does he feel about the new shoes? And that's one thing he said. He was extremely upset that he retired before those shoes hit the market. Otherwise, he reckoned he would have run sub 2.
Did he commit to a number?
He committed to sub 2 if he'd had those shoes.
So he reckons, because what did he end up doing? He went 2:03, didn't he?
Something like that. Yeah.
Look, so he's saying 3 minutes. I think that's a bit much. I think that's a little bit of bravado, maybe. I still think it's a minute and 90 seconds.
Yeah. I suppose the question is he a better athlete than Kipchoge in the marathon? He certainly had the track pedigree.
Yeah, exactly.
That was better.
But thanks to tech, we'll never know. Yeah. Moving right on.
Yeah. Moving on, this is what was described as the course for the marathon at the Paris 2024 Olympics as a spectacular, demanding, and unprecedented race. And that's for the Paris Olympics in 2024.
Yeah.
Why is it spectacular, demanding, and unprecedented?
Because they put a hill in it, heaven forbid.
Oh, my goodness.
I know.
The drama.
I know. It's got a lot of vertical elevation. I think 400-odd meters. And there's two significant moments. The one comes from memory now. I don't have it in front of me, but about 15K. There's a 5K drag. And the map that they published is not the greatest resolution, but it looks to me to climb about sort of 50 meters. Sorry, it goes from 25 meters to 180, so 150 meters over 5K. That's 3%.
Mm-hmm.
Then they drop down a little bit, and then from 28 to 29, there's a 1K pull that looks to my eye to be about 5-6%. And that's long and steep, more than they would encounter in any of the major marathons. I mean, Boston's got the Heartbreak Hills, but
that's not really a hill.
You've seen those, right? Yeah. You've done that. I mean, that's like a little, it's a little slope.
It's a slope, yeah. To be honest with you, I'm delighted that this is happening. Because
it's great.
The one thing, and we've talked about this in the podcast before, I never understand, and notwithstanding the performance of Kipchoge and at Berlin, there are the most best part of watching any kind of race is to watch the race itself. So for us to see, you know, a race happening instead of somebody just chasing a good time, especially Olympic marathon. The Olympic marathon is not about time. It's about the race for me. And the fact that this course now is delivering a race that I think will be fascinating to watch.
Yeah, and the hills come at really good times tactically, because from 15 to 20 k is the 5k drag, and it, as I've just pulled the profile up here, it does, it goes from about 30 meters above sea level to 183, so that's 3%. Then there's about a 8-9k gradual descent, and then the very steep hill with 13k 14k to go, and that's a good spot for a decisive move. And then once you peak that at 29k, there's about 3k's of pretty severe descending. So tired legs at that speed and that eccentric load, and then you finish along the River Seine towards Hotel de Invalide, and that's going to change
things. Well, it's a well-named hotel for that course.
Yeah, they finish on the Esplanade de Invalide there in front of the Napoleon's tomb. And I reckon, A, it's in August, so that's going to be maybe slightly warmer than most are accustomed to, plus the hills. I reckon there's some people who'd be looking at that and saying, I can prepare smartly for this, and I can get a jump on guys who on a London, Berlin, Chicago would beat me.
Yep.
I'm going to actually turn the tables on them because of the route. Everyone's going to be behind Kipchoge, assuming he runs it.
Yeah.
But the rest will be interesting.
Yeah, because it's not just about pure speed anymore.
Mm, yeah, exactly. That's a cool.
So it's exciting. I'm glad to see. It's almost, they're almost doing it like you would prepare for a recycling event.
Yeah.
You need to put a hill in to decide who wins the race.
Yeah, if anything, I could have moved the hills 5K later. Then it would have been really spicy.
Yeah. Or finish on a hill even better.
Yes. But, and it also takes in all the monuments. I mean, it's going to be visually spectacular. Mm. Can't wait.
Great. Looking forward to that. Mm. Now, this is an interesting story. I know Ross has been doing all these stories coming via Ross today because he's been trolling the interwebs for some interesting stuff. And this is a classic one, a cheating scandal in angling.
I know.
And when I first thought about the story, I thought, how do you cheat in angling? And when I found out what they were doing, it was obvious. But how do they do it?
Well, it was in an angling competition in Ohio, $30,000 prize. Eh? So this is not chump change. And these two guys who'd apparently been winning more than they should have. That was the first sign of suspicion. I bring that up because it's
Jacob Runyon and Chase Kaminsky.
That's right. Classic sign of like dominance equals suspicion, even in angling apparently. And so they're a little bit suspicious and they bring their fish up for the weigh-in at the end, and it gets weighed and everyone's eyebrows lift and they say that. And the guy who's doing the weighing, the organizer, he's got a lot of experience weighing fish. He says, these don't look like 15 kilogram weights, you know, like, because they were 33 pounds or something. He says, no, they look like 15 to 20s. They weigh 30 something. Let's cut them open. So they cut them open and they remove about 8 pounds worth of lead balls that have been hidden inside other filleted fish so that they didn't knock about on the inside. I mean, and everyone starts jeering. And it confirmed, as I gather from reading articles, there's a video of this, by the way, you can find it on TikTok, of the weighing. And you can see the reaction of the crowd and everyone gets unhappy and so forth. They haven't commented, but, I mean, how do you deny the fact that your fish have got these lead balls inside them? They're literally on the video, they show him cut them open and he dumps the balls inside a crate. It's hilarious.
It is, actually. What we'll do is we'll make sure we put all the links in the show notes. You can actually look at the story on Sky News, where it actually is quite a well-written piece, a bit tongue-in-cheek and a bit of fun. But
yeah, there's lots of puns available.
Lots of pun news. It's a journalist's dream, really. Yeah.
But I saw another interesting piece that they needed, I forget what it was to win. I think they needed about 15, 16 pounds to win the overall title. Mm. They way overdid the lead balls because they came in at 33. if they'd gotten their dosage right, they would have probably got away with it, because then it would have been, okay, it's 2 pounds heavier than it should have been.
It's a big boned fish.
But they went way over what they needed to. Yeah. And so they weren't particularly. But the suspicion is there that they've been cheating for a long time, because they'd been winning many competitions, and the way it's told in the story is that, and I can imagine this is the case, I've never caught a fish in my life, but there's a great deal of luck involved, so you shouldn't win regularly.
Yeah.
And they were, so everyone was a bit suspicious and then had their suspicions confirmed.
I can imagine that for those of you who watch reality TV, there's a show about tuna fishermen and I think it's off the sort of east coast of America, and they're really catching some big fish, a couple of lead weights, you would never be able to spot those in the stomach of those fish. Yeah. But I guess they do cut them open and fillet them, so you would spot something suspicious.
So here it is. They needed 16.89 pounds to claim Team of the Year. Their weight was 33.91.
Yeah. So
they literally doubled the cheating dosage.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's it's funny because it's just the human condition is we cheat. You know what I mean? Like that's what it is. And there's another sport you wouldn't necessarily associate with cheating, which we'll get onto next, I suppose, in chess. But it's like when you offer money and prestige and pride, humans will cheat. So unless you're a couple of weeks back on our last podcast, we spoke about the Navy SEALs. Okay, that's more than just a little team of the year fishing trophy at stake. But they do it there too. And they do it in all sports. And it's just the way of life, unfortunately.
Yeah. So a couple of other things talking about cheating, boxing, doping scandals developing at the moment as well. A bunch of Portuguese cyclists banned.
Yeah.
I mean, as you say, it's rampant, isn't it? I mean, there's money involved. I mean,
the boxing one especially, you know, it's a fight between two guys whose fathers were also legendary boxers, Ben and Eubank Jr., Chris Eubank Jr., whose father actually was involved in a fight that caused severe brain damage to an opponent, and so was Conor Ben's. Conor Ben then fails a test for something called clomiphene, which is a selective estrogen receptor modulator, and basically it's used to treat infertility in women, but in men it elevates testosterone levels because it messes about with your normal, because you can imagine your testosterone levels are tightly controlled. It's not like a random system. There's a homeostatic balanced loop that regulates it. And what I've subsequently heard from a number of people is that when you are doping with testosterone, your body stops making its own. And so when you come off the testosterone cycle, you have to switch yours back on. And this is one way that you might do that. Or you just use this drug to elevate your testosterone levels by itself. But either way, this Ben's A sample comes back positive. And so now the fight's in jeopardy, and it's a big fight. But now they're saying, no, the fight can go ahead because the B sample hasn't been tested yet. So they're going to proceed with it. And Chris Eubank Jr., who's the opponent, is saying he's happy to go with it.
Well, because there's money involved.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's just an amazing story. And so there's
It doesn't matter who wins as long as they get paid.
That's the problem, you know. It's all on show up for the big fight. And you know, in boxing, this is a big deal. The other thing at stake here is that Eubank Jr. has to come down a lot in weight to make the fight.
Mm.
And
maybe they'll reach a compromise.
Well, so there's significant safety concerns here. It's just, there's an article this morning, Rick Broadbent of the Times has written a piece on it and written about just how distasteful the whole thing is. And it is, it's like you're talking about guys who are going to go into a ring and literally try and beat each other up with consent, of course. And now you've got doping in there, you've got drastic weight cuts going on, weakness is a consequence of that. I mean, this is not... You talk about safety in sport, and at what point does our entertainment become actually...
I suppose that's where the authorities around boxing need to make a stand and show some leadership, I guess.
And even there, the British Board of Control for Boxing wants the fight not to proceed. I think I've got that right, because there's conflict there. So, in fact, let me not attribute the wrong action to them in this regard.
It would make sense for them to be involved in that and not let it go ahead.
Yeah, so the British Board of Boxing Control is saying that the fight should be prohibited as it is not in the interest of boxing. And they told the promoters not to proceed with the fight. But they're saying, well, the UK anti-doping has tested him and found him to be negative. There's two anti-doping authorities, by the way. There's one called VADA, which is the Voluntary Anti-Doping Association, as opposed to the involuntary which is UCAD. UCAD is saying our tests are negative. Both boxers want to fight. All okay. Happy days. Let's go. It's just...
Sure.
And then you, as I say, you lay on upon that the weight cutting requirements. There's apparently a clause where one of the fighters has agreed not to gain too much weight after the weigh-in. So everyone's aware of the risks, but we'll go because the money's enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's bad.
The Portuguese riders, seven Portuguese riders banned for doping offences. I mean, there are some pretty big names in there, and it's weird to see so many caught at the same time.
Well, it's all from one team, and that team has now had its license taken away. Yeah. In fact, that was in July. There was a raid. Goes to show the good old, for all the good anti-doping does, a good old police raid.
Blows
things open, always delivers. And that's what happened here. So the team that's won many of those races in Portugal has had a number of its riders caught with banned substances, ranging from corticosteroids onwards. And it's interesting because I remember seeing an analysis of the climbing performances in the Tour of Portugal, and they are every bit as good as the Tour de France, if not better. Yet you don't see climbers regularly winning Tour de France stages from those teams, or from Portugal even. And it's simply because there's a different approach to anti-doping. And they just, so that's what's come to a head here now. And maybe it's a turning point where anti-doping in Portugal starts to actually filter out the behaviors. But it's long, I think, been known that there is rampant doping among some of those particularly sub-elite, or, you know, not the pro teams, the elite tour teams.
And I mean, it says the longest suspension was reserved for João Rodrigues, obviously a pretty big name in the world.
He won
the Volta Algarve, he was banned for 7 years.
Yeah, so that's
That's pretty much the end of his career.
Exactly,
he's already a pretty much a veteran now anyway.
Right, and then speaking of doping, we spoke about it a while back. Nairo Quintana became the first athlete to be suspended for tramadol use.
Yes,
because the UCI was the only sport that put it on its regulated list. I'm not even going to say banned, but now WADA has banned it.
Right.
And
so it's not just a recommendation anymore.
It's no longer a recommendation. It's a ban. And it will be banned from next year. Now, there's a question, and Renato Cironi wrote in again on Patreon and said, well, why wait? And I think that's just an artifact of how they run. They've designed their list to be updated coincident with calendar years. But, you know, the interesting thing about that is nothing else has changed other than Quintana being caught. There's no new evidence that it works. There's no new evidence that it's harmful. The same conversations are being had now in 2022 as were being had in 2016-17.
Yeah.
And now it's enough to ban it. Why? Yeah. So it just comes across.
Sounds like it's just a bit of pressure now.
Exactly. It's profile pressure. It's knee jerk. It's, you know, there goes the horse, close the barn door, you know, kind of thing. Anyway, it's good that it's been banned. It's just weird. And it's not weird. It's kind of par for the course that it took a case to, you know, tip the seesaw in the direction it should have gone a long time ago.
Yeah. And a final loose segment piece, I mean, before we get on to some rather interesting interviews, which we'll get to very shortly, is a new paper suggesting that transgender women retain advantage up to 14 years after they've had that transgender. I mean, this is obviously something we talked about a lot on the podcast,
but
there's always this discussion about how long does the advantage last, and for 14 years is now pretty significant.
Yeah, and the thing about this paper, and the reason I'm not super excited about it, it's gotten a little bit of media coverage in the last few days, is it's a cross-sectional study, which basically means they've assessed them now, on average 14 and a half years after they've suppressed testosterone, as opposed to the dozen studies or so that we've discussed in the past where they followed them from day zero onwards. That version is like watching the movie develop.
Yeah.
What this is effectively a photograph midway or halfway or towards the end of the movie. And so you don't know what they were like at the start. You only know what they look like now. But what is clear is that what they look like now is still significantly heavier, significantly more muscle mass, significantly stronger, and a higher absolute VO2. So that's oxygen capacity, cardiovascular capacity in a sense.
Which is kind of what you've always alluded to, is that the advantages are there.
And a lot of them are related to size. And when you look at the VO2, for instance, relative to mass, then the VO2 max per kilogram per milliliter, moles per kilogram per minute is the same between them. So relatively, they look the same. In absolute terms, different. Now, that's got implications for the performance advantage in sports in a different way. Some sports, relative matters a lot more because it's weight limited, cycling up a hill, running, for instance. Other sports, rowing, swimming, I dare say, cycling, track cycling on a flat road, the absolute one might be more. But for me, the more interesting finding is the strength advantage is retained, and it's about 19%, their hand grip strength. Muscle mass is maintained. And so this is not, of all the studies, this is probably quite low in terms of strength because of that cross-sectional nature, but it's a puzzle piece in the same picture that we've been looking at for the last few years. So that's why it was noteworthy.
Now, in our next segment, we've got a very interesting interview with one of our most popular guests here on the Science and Sport podcast, Sean Ingle, who's the chief sports writer for The Guardian. And he talks to us a little bit about a cheating scandal in the world of chess. So it's not often we get a chance to talk about chess on the Science and Sport podcast. And Sean Ingle, our favourite journalist from The Guardian in London, who we've often interviewed on the podcast, welcome back. What is happening in the controversial world of chess at the moment?
Well, there's been a cheating scandal, which I'm sure your listeners would have heard of, that started last month when Magnus Carlsen, the world champion, walked out of a prestigious tournament for the first time in his career. And he made some very cryptic remarks about cheating. And since then, we've had a I guess, a drama that's been part soap opera, part whodunit, as people have tried to work out how much cheating was involved, you know, and so on. There have been outlandish theories. We've heard of vibrating anal beads has entered the popular discourse. And and as we speak, there is still a lot of uncertainty and speculation. But a couple of days ago, chess.com, which is the world's biggest website, produced a 72-page dossier where they sort of outlined cheating at top-level chess, particularly involving Castle's opponent the day, a guy called Hans Niemann, who's a 19-year-old American.
Yeah, I was on vacation mostly, so I sort of caught headlines only, which is why we wanted you for the detail. As I understand it, most of it has happened in online matches.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Yeah, so Carlsen lost this game in the Singfield Cup, which is a $500,000 tournament. I think what spooked Carlsen was two things. One, that Niemann said after the game that he'd sort of been working on this exact series of moves that Carlsen ended up playing that morning, which I think Carlsen was surprised by. And also, Carlsen clearly had conversations with other players who had expressed their concerns that they thought Niemann was cheating, and sort of a day later he admitted he cheated twice as a 12-year-old and a 16-year-old, but only online, and he sort of insisted he's never cheated on over the board, and had even offered to play naked to sort of prove that he wasn't hiding an electromagnetic device or such like. But yeah, you're right, most of the cheating has been online rather than over the board.
I would have thought that online chess cheating would be rampant and widespread, especially with $500,000 purses.
Well, this tournament was over the board, but there have been some big tournaments with big money online as well. And at the very top level, what they do, they make you install cameras sort of around the room, which should help a bit. And also, every game goes through cheat detection software. Now, the various websites, they don't sort of tell you exactly what they're doing, but clearly if you play the top move of the computer every single time, if you do things like click onto another browser, which could have a chess engine open, if you perhaps take unusual amount of times over certain moves, they could all be indicators that you are potentially cheating. And in these very top online tournaments where there are cameras, they can, you would hope, see if there was anything nefarious going on.
Now, the Wall Street Journal published something which is either what you just alluded to from chess.com, or is that something separate where they've forensically showed that this American player has cheated more often than the twice that he claimed to have done?
Yeah, now that was the same report that chess.com clearly given that in advance to the Wall Street Journal. Interestingly, chess.com quoted sort of the world's leading anti-cheating expert, Ken Rogan, who supported their verdict that Niemann had cheated over 100 times. But they did also accept there was a lack of concrete statistical evidence that Niemann had cheated either in his game against Magnus or in any other over-the-board games. So there is this sort of, we are in a bit of a limbo here where he's accepted cheating on the one hand, but sort of said, well, it was a while ago. Chess.com have come back and said, actually, it was a lot more times. But even they accept that nothing over the board, and also nothing since 2020 that they can categorically say as he's cheated.
And the authorities, they're saying we'll investigate. Is there any timeline on when that may happen?
Yeah, well, not officially, but unofficially, I've been told sort of around next 3 months or so. So we're looking around, I guess, by the end of the year.
How do they cheat? I mean, you alluded to the fact that it's to do with using software to plan moves. Is that what the cheating mechanism is, as far as you know?
Well, I mean, there are various ways you can do it. I guess we'll start with the cases that have been caught. Probably the most famous case was a Latvian grandmaster called Igor Rausis. Now, he was getting quite old and his ranking had been coming down. But then he started to win a bunch of games and that aroused a bunch of suspicion. And eventually one tournament put a camera in the toilet and they saw that what he'd done was he'd stuck his phone in the toilet paper holder. And every time there was a crucial move that he had to make, he'd go along and, you know, unzip the toilet paper from its holder and then and get to his phone. So that's how he cheated and they caught him doing that. There was another famous case at the 2010 Olympiad where a French player, Sebastian Feller, was playing. And he had two assistants, one of whom was online monitoring his game and looking at what the computer was saying, and another who was actually in the playing hall or nearby, who would actually walk. They had established a code. So we'd walk to a certain table and that would indicate a certain square on the board. So if you wanted to move your piece from B2 to B4, he would then, you know, walk to those two tables, and that's how they cheated that way. When it comes to Neiman and this sort of wild theory about vibrating anal beads, the theory here is that if you're a top chess grandmaster, and I've spoken to sort of top players about this, sometimes all you need is a sense that there is something in the position. So it might not be obvious, but if you are told, look, there's a key killer move here that gives you a big advantage, most of the top players will find it. So, you know, if you had something that vibrated or buzzed you, that would be one thing. The other way it could potentially happen is some sort of Morse code or some sort of, you know, beep, beep might mean B if he beeps twice. And then the next one might beep, might indicate the number of squares the piece moves from. So there are potentially ways to do it, but I'm not convinced it's that easy to do, certainly in over the board play.
If I understand correctly, Magnus Carlsen, now the world number one, probably the most famous chess player right now. And he's playing this game. He makes one move and then quits. That's how it unfolded.
There were two games. So the first time he plays is at the Ziegfeld Cup, which is the prestigious tournament that's over the board in St. Louis in America. Then a week later, they're playing another tournament, the Meltwater Champions Generation Cup, I think it was. And they were scheduled to play again. So Neiman plays his first move. Magnus plays his first move. Neiman plays his second move. The Magnus resigns and disconnects.
That's the one I was talking about.
Yeah.
Now, for a guy at that profile and that level to make that public a statement against it, he must know. Well, in his own mind, he must be absolutely convinced. Because if Neiman's exonerated, then Carlsen has effectively very publicly accused him of something falsely. He has to know.
Well, I think, I guess if you are told that you're up against a cheat, even if that person isn't cheating in that game against you, you perhaps think they are. So that someone like Carlsen, who, I mean, I've interviewed him a few times, and I think he's brutally honest about himself and his play. You know, he praises opponents a lot and he's very self-critical. So I absolutely believe that he thinks something is fishy going on. Whether he can absolutely prove it, I don't know. But as I said earlier, I think that combination of Neiman knowing or apparently seeming to know the sort of 15 or so moves that Magnus thought, you know, the line he was going to take him into in that first game absolutely threw him. And with that knowledge that he knew that I think Neiman had cheated online in the past, he put two and two together, and whether he's got the right answer or not, we still don't know for sure.
It's bold. I mean, you've got a boxing scandal where a guy's failed a test and his opponent is saying he's happy to fight. It's unusual for a player to make a public stand against an opponent, right?
No, absolutely. And I think what's also quite interesting in this, I mean, we all come from and we all follow sports that are more sort of aligned to the world anti-doping code. And there we sort of know that actually, you know, if I take EPO and I'm caught, it's probably a 4-year ban. If I do it again, it's probably an 8-year ban, et cetera, et cetera. In chess, it's a lot more Wild West with companies like chess.com or our private companies. So what they've effectively done in the past, and their report essentially says that four of the top 100 in the world have admitted cheating to them, and dozens more title players have as well. What they've effectively done in the past is banned them quietly, shadow banned them, and said, look, if you confess, we'll let you play again. So they've got a bunch. So that is a very distant. And so the punishment is never made public. There's no real official sanction for cheating. There is an over the ball tournament, but that's been very rare. So we're in this sort of strange situation where it's not absolutely obvious, you know, what the sanction should be. And certainly for someone like Neiman, if he cheated at 12 and 16, what should the punishment be? So it's very different to say the wider code, really.
As for Neiman, best case now is that an official report exonerates him. But I mean, his reputation's done.
Well, he was back playing last night in the US Championship, and he won his game against Christoph Yu, a 15-year-old. And afterwards, he sort of said, I'm letting my chest do the talking. I'm not going to let this affect me. So it's an extraordinary case because Neiman is someone that he's 19 now, but he's actually developed as a top player very late, which raises statistical flags. I think for the other players, raise flags, because generally progress is never in a sort of never linear, but he's sort of had very fallow peers and suddenly shot up by a huge amount. And generally, you know, even the top youngsters that end up being at 2700 plus level who are super geniuses don't tend to do that. So he is a statistical anomaly. But I guess unless he is caught definitively cheating over the board, we'd probably continue as we are. I mean, chess.com have banned him online, but he's allowed to play, you know, in other tournaments online and also, in matches in real life. So watch this space.
Yeah, I'm going to watch this and wait for the movie.
So thanks very much, Sean Ingle, and always lovely to hear from a man who is very close to many of the controversies in sport, and always lovely to have him on the show. So our next guest in our interview for the day comes the way of a gentleman by the name of Professor Stuart Phillips, who is a professor and Tier 1 Canada Research Chair in the Department of Kinesiology at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. And the reason why we're talking to Stu is because we've been wanting to do this for quite some time, but he's going to talk to us very much around the very controversial subject of protein and its role in sport and how it works. Why is it such a talking point, sport and protein? It's trendy, but why?
So when I was doing honours, we did obviously a lot on biochemistry of exercise and so on. And I remember you do like 2 weeks of work on carbs and then 2 week block of lectures on fat and about one morning on protein. I remember this, and this was a twist 20 years ago now, obviously, so it's a while. But at that time, protein was neglected because I think most people were kind of like, okay, it's the third of the three macronutrients. We know that it's important because it's enzymes, it's muscle, it's structural, it has these roles. Stuart will talk to us about those. But it's hard to study, for one thing, because you have to do some pretty gnarly collection of all kinds of samples from the body in order to understand what's really happening with nitrogen and amino acids. And secondly, I think a lot of people put it in people put it in the too hard box. But it's gained a lot of traction recently because people have started to say, actually, well, let's focus on protein a little bit more and talk a little bit about it. And every person who's training, whether it's for health or performance, and whether that performance is endurance or strength or muscle gain, is now interested in protein because that's literally what makes you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we talk, and then concurrent, there's been this increased focus in recovery. You know, we're breaking down the body with training. To get better, we must recover, and that's protein related as well. So I think those things have driven this little micro industry, and people like Stuart, who've been studying this stuff for 3 decades, have become more and more in demand because people recognize how important it is. So I've heard him speak at a conference once or twice, I think it is, two times, and his delivery is always very simple and straightforward. He's a no-nonsense, simple, clear thinker, you know, accurate and precise, and tried for a long time to get him on. Most of the time it was us who couldn't accommodate him in Canada. But eventually we got him, and you know, a couple of patrons had asked about protein. Special shout out to Philippe Tukala, who'd asked a few questions about it. And hopefully we cover what you want to know in this interview.
Well, it's a very enlightening interview with Stu Phillips, and here it is. Well, Stu, welcome to the Science of Sport podcast. I know that Ross has been trying to get you on our podcast for a few months now, and it's really lovely having you on the show. Where are you talking to us from? Ontario, I believe.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, well, thanks for having me on the show first. McMaster University, so we're in Hamilton.
I think most people would say we're about 40 kilometers outside of Toronto. That would be where most people would identify geographically where we are.
Now, when we decided to do this podcast and Ross said he's going to be talking about protein, the first thing that comes to mind is that if there's anything that's been a buzzword in this sports world in the last probably 10 years, it's been about protein. And I know for myself, working on magazines like Runner's World and Bicycling, you know, there's every month we have some story. It's either about protein or it's about carbohydrate. And the science changes all the time. And you, I'm sure you have had this in Canada as well as we've had it in South Africa, so much stuff around keto diets and protein based diets, that sort of thing, and of course protein supplements, which of course are massive. And
I will say though that protein is both simultaneously like the fashionable sort of trendy macronutrient, but also for a very long time the forgotten one. It's almost like people said, all right, carbs, fat, and make the rest protein. Just how much protein do I need? Whatever you don't get from the others, have that. So it's a funny like dichotomy of both neglected and hyped.
And I think for us in South Africa, we've obviously had a very close, and Ross particularly has had a close relationship with Professor Tim Noakes, who in the day was a big carbohydrate fan, particularly in athletes. And then suddenly he became a banter and a keto diet and that sort of thing. So we've had massive shifts here in South Africa around that. But I guess my opening question as a non-scientific person is there is so much hype around protein. Maybe it's a general question about, is the hype warranted?
Yeah, I think your characterization of, you know, things going in and out of vogue, you know, when I first started doing sort of sports science, and so I mean, I've been at McMaster now for 25 years, and it's sort of, you know, I know, well, I say that to a lot of people, and they're like, where did the time go, right? But, you know, my first ACSM meeting, I went in, and every other symposium was how to carb, how many, you know, what did you have to drink to get these amount of carbohydrates in? And so, you know, carbohydrates had their moment in the sun. And I think Louise Burke probably sort of described it best, is that we went maybe overboard on how much carbohydrate you needed without tailoring the prescription to the intensity and duration of the sport, et cetera. So now we've gotten a bit more refined. And then carbohydrates took a bit of a backseat. And then it was all about fat. And, you know, even though we went through, I call them the fat phobic 80s, where, you know, fat was bad, carbs were good. And then all of a sudden fat was good. So now it's protein's turn. Our time to shine, so to speak. I mean, I think the basic distinction to make for your audience is to remind everybody that carbohydrates and fats, you know, 99%, they're fuel, right? You're putting them in a system and you're burning them. There's a small structural role and probably developmental role for certain essential fatty acids, long chain fatty acids. Protein's fundamentally different. It's a substrate that's used to make things. It's used to make, you know, structural proteins, enzymes, you know, everything that has a sort of a solid structure in your body, including your bones. And there's a news flash, your bones are 40% by composition protein. It's not just a stick of chalk. you have to use it. The difference is, you know, unlike fat, where we have an, you know, seemingly endless capacity to store that, and carbohydrates, which we have a limited capacity for storage, you can't store protein. So it's not like you can eat it and then sort of stack it away somewhere and then release it at a later time. And I know some people sort of have theories about that, but if there is a pool of stored quote unquote protein, it's very small. I doubt whether you know anybody can really tap into it. If you're really stressed, then yeah, we break down our muscle, and you know, that's where we really get into trouble. But there's a fundamental difference in, you know, that's pretty much what's occupied my time for the last 25-30 years.
Mike, go ahead.
Can I just, I mean, it's maybe an overly technical question, but when you talk about proteins being the structural components of things, maybe you can explain how proteins do become structural components of things. So you ingest some protein, and then your muscles get bigger, your bones get stronger. How does that process actually happen?
Or you get fatter, but
or you get fatter.
It's like everything. I mean, if you eat too much of anything, you're going to put on weight. That's the way. I mean, that's a fundamental. You know, we can skirt around thermodynamics in some sort of sense, but that's kind of how it works. In my mind, anyway. Not everybody's. I'll admit. I mean, I think the easiest analogy and the one that I use most often and people can kind of grab onto is to say, proteins are made up. It's like bricks of a wall. And if it's our skin, if it's our muscle, it doesn't really matter. And there are 20 bricks, and we can make 11 of those bricks in our body. We can manufacture them ourselves from just things that we ingest. We don't necessarily have to have the protein in our diets, but 9 of those bricks are what we call essential. And the bricks, of course, are, we call them amino acids, and they're strung together in a long chain, and the chain folds in on itself, and it eventually makes a protein structure that when you sort of stick them all together, then you begin to build up muscle proteins, you begin to build up skin proteins, liver proteins, blood proteins, et cetera. So if you like, we need to have protein coming in our diet every day to provide those essential bricks, those 9 essential bricks. And when we don't get those, then we're going to break down certain structures to provide those for other processes. And the analogy I used to say is that there's a brick wall. And if you want the brick wall to function well, you're going to have a guy at one end putting bricks into the wall and a guy at the other end taking out the bad or damaged bricks. And that's kind of like a constant, what we call it turnover. Mm. And it keeps the walls in tip-top shape. And everybody goes, the walls. And I'm like, well, imagine your muscle's a wall, but your skin is the same type of thing. And we're turning over those proteins on a constant basis to keep everything functioning as well as it can.
Yeah, so this was going to be my question, but yours was better, actually. I like the mechanism stuff. But we're getting to the same point now, and I'll pick your analogy up. So the role of diets is to deliver bricks to those bricklayers and breakdowners, whatever you want to call them. I suppose the million-dollar question is, how many bricks do we need to bring daily?
Yeah.
And I know that's an almightily complex answer, because it depends on the function of the wall and what you're trying to achieve with it. And are we trying to gain weight? Are we trying to be healthy? Are we trying to, there's all sorts of health and performance implications. So it'll take a while to answer, but that's the question.
Yeah. I mean, that's the one, again, 25, 30 years of doing that. So
that's the million-dollar question.
I think when I got into this, and this is sort of maybe the step back picture, and to say to people that the recommended dietary allowance, or the RDA, it's called various things around the world, but it's generally set at about 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight per day. And when I first got into this, all I heard was the RDA is sufficient. You don't need to eat more protein. Even athletes who are working really, really hard, they don't need more protein. The RDA is just fine. Without getting too deep into the weeds, the recommended dietary allowance, or the recommended nutrient intake, whatever it's called, in my opinion, and the opinion of several other people, it's just not sufficient for athletes. Mm. And we could sort of dichotomize it into, say, endurance athletes and resistance trained athletes. And I think most people think, well, if you're resistance training, you're trying to gain muscle, you're trying to maintain muscle, so you actually need more protein. The reality is that in just about every experiment that's being done with endurance athletes, mainly because they're burning a lot of fuel, they tend to burn, even though it's a small amount of what they do burn or oxidize for fuel, they burn some amino acids. And in doing so, then they have an increased requirement for these are the essential, or what we call the essential bricks or essential amino acids. So they need to eat more protein to get that back into their system to keep things working efficiently. Mm. People who lift weights, yeah, absolutely. They probably have a small increase in need, but they benefit from a little bit more protein. The numbers have changed, and my targets have changed based on science. And I know that tends to upset people, because you can't give a definitive answer. But I stop short of some really extraordinarily high intakes and say about double the RDA, or about 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight per day, is a level that appears to cover both endurance athletes, even with increased needs for protein because of oxidation, and resistance trained athletes with increased protein needs because they're trying to maintain and or gain muscle. Beyond that, your body can absorb tons of protein. I think that that's really a message that people maybe forget. They sort of think there's a finite capacity to absorb protein, and that's not like you can absorb lots and lots. I've had athletes consuming 4 and 5 times what I'm recommending, and they'll absorb it, but they just can't use it. You don't have a place to put it away. And when that happens, then everything from fish all the way to mammals has evolved a mechanism of getting rid of nitrogen. If you're a fish, it's ammonia. If you're a bird, it's uric acid. If you're a mammal, it's urea. So you either use it or you pull the nitrogen off and you lose it. So about 1.6 is that's the short answer to with a long explanation, but about 1.6, I think.
Within the field of I suppose generally nutrition, but specifically this area, that RDA probably dates back to 70s, 80s, 40 years old now.
Oh yeah, at least that. It's sort of this. The way it's treated, and I don't know that it will change. So I've sort of got on a campaign to, instead of saying recommended dietary allowance, I don't think it should be recommended, and I think you should be allowed to eat more. If we just called it the minimum dietary intake, in other words, it covers needs, then I could stop railing on about this and walk away and go, okay, mission accomplished. But until that happens, I don't think it's really doing justification to the, that as an intake. And then it becomes one of not just need, but what would you consume to have optimal health, or if you're an athlete, optimal performance or optimal function, for example.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. I mean, if we defined athletes who are training a lot, let's say 12 or more hours a week, in some instances 20 hours plus, by how much would that go up from the 1.6? Or is your 1.6 targeted at them? In other words,
yeah. I think 1.6 covers it for the most part, 10 and 12 hours a week. I think the point is, and I was on a podcast recently with Chris Gardner from Stanford, and he was sort of making the point that all athletes are getting enough protein. And, in my experience, looking at food records and just dealing with athletes over the years, if they're covering their energy needs and they're consuming a mixed diet, and I'll just say, so they have to be a little bit judicious about what they eat. They can't just be mindlessly eating. They're generally getting enough protein as long as they're covering their energy needs. Now, you guys know as well as I do that there are groups of athletes, particularly aesthetic sport oriented, and some groups of female athletes that really restrict what they eat. And those athletes can get into problems. But if it's sort of, I can use the analogy on your podcast, and it's my favorite sport. So, if they're a bunch of rugby players, they're eating a lot of food and they're getting more than enough protein. It's a fait accompli. But one of the things is to emphasize is that the RDA is not optimal for those athletes. And that's maybe different than the question of how much do you need and what is optimally, there for, you to take advantage and perform well. And that's a different question. And it's much tougher to answer, to be fair.
So if I'm at the risk of oversimplifying, if I'm a training athlete or a coach of an athlete who's training, priority number one is the energy demands of what I'm doing in training. And it's fuel for the work required, to quote Graham Close. We interviewed him, I think, last season.
Oh, okay, great.
Beyond that, the macronutrient composition of that diet obviously matters. Mm-hmm. If I have protein but insufficient energy, I'm not doing enough. And if I have sufficient energy but a minimum or your targeted amount of protein, then I've got more than enough, and having more protein is not beneficial necessarily. It's potentially wasteful.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that, to your point, we've known for a long time that if you don't meet your energy needs, you will begin to, pull protein out of stores. You're going to put a stress on the system. The fuel needs are, that's fat and carbohydrate. The protein comes out of the system in order to sort of make up for differences. And, the fundamental truism is that amino acids that are released from, we'll call it storage, but the reality is that's going to be your muscle, because it's the largest reservoir of stored amino acids you have. is the use of those amino acids to maintain blood glucose levels, so gluconeogenesis. And you know, that's a tremendous stress on the system. If you're not able to maintain that level, the body fights to keep that you know, blood glucose at a very constant level. So, you know, in those circumstances, then you will break down and use body protein stores. If you've got sufficient energy, then you're probably not going to be in that state. And even if you're sort of at the minimal level of protein, you'll be fine. Mm. I just don't know that would maximize the advantage of protein for higher intakes. You know, where that stops and, you know, is a much tougher proposition. But I'm sort of, you know, 1.6 is where I think you've squeezed a lot of benefit out of the cloth, and you've got a lot of water down here. But you know, you can, and people say, what about, you know, 2.2, because that's the maybe upper end. And I'm like, well, it's like, you know, you can kind of get one last drop out, but you've got a lot of what you need with 1.6.
Right. So then what about the opposite case? It's one thing to talk about having insufficient and how much I need to get to. Once I exceed that, we talk about wasteful, but does it ever become harmful?
Yeah, good question. I mean, so the usual two things that people talk about, too much protein makes your blood, if you like, acidic, and it does sort of shift pH. And then that causes calcium to, if you like, you know, leach out of your bones, and you increase urinary excretion of calcium, and, you know, your bones become soft. And so that's what we call it, the acid ash hypothesis. So acidic blood, because of elevated protein and other food sources as well, for the record, causes, you know, this ash or this calcium to come out of your bones. That's been refuted now, you know, I think categorically, if you like, debunked several times over. The increased calcium excretion actually comes from increased calcium absorption. You know, calcium, as long as it's sufficient in your diet, and vitamin or vitamin maybe, and your pronunciation D, if they're adequate, then protein is actually, it's a beneficial, a synergistically beneficial nutrient for bone. As I said, you know, bone is 40% by composition protein. So the increased urinary excretion is as a result of increased calcium uptake. So I think we can kind of dust that one off and push it to the side. The next big one, you know, that most people have been classically taught, if they went through any human physiology or they're trained in medicine, is that protein causes, you know, kidney problems, kidney failure. Uh-huh. You know, that's would say it's about a 60 to 70 year old thesis now. Brenner is the guy that came up with it. It's a little bit of an example of what you would know Brandolini's law is that the order of evidence taken to refute something that's out there is 10 times the, you know, in the order of magnitude of what it took to get it out there.
You've used the polite version, yes.
Yeah, I did. I did. You know, it's
fair.
It's the Canadian way. We're sort of straddling that line. So, you know, don't offend anybody. So yeah, believe me. You know, and here we are, fast forward 60 years, and when you do the, you know, the thorough literature review and look for the evidence for that, you can't find it. So, and we've done systematic reviews, and other people have as well. And, you know, and people are fond of saying, you know, absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. And I'm like, yeah, but it's been 60 years and we're still looking. Like, maybe the hypothesis was incorrect. And people point to an observation that they make, and it's true. People with chronic kidney disease who are put on lower protein diets, because now you have less solute to filter, less urea, but all, you know, they lower everything, less sodium, less potassium, you know, everything goes down. They live longer and their kidneys function for longer. But that doesn't mean by reverse, you know, corollary causation that the protein caused the kidney failure. But it's a remarkable, like, you know, I mean, urologists unite and you know, sort of bash, you know, over and over at this. And I'm like, show me the evidence that of causality or even association, even observational association. And it's pretty damn thin. So I'm beginning to think we can, you know, and that's why I get on these podcasts to try and tell people, I'm like, just show me something good. So show me your best data that would convince people that that's the case. You know,
You're suggesting then that there's a couple of things that we know there isn't enough evidence to support things like it affects kidneys. Do we know if there's anything that is a result of high protein consumption? Is there any downside to it?
Right. I'll call it the most recent kid on the block is that higher protein begets higher levels of hormones like insulin, like growth factor, which is, you know, it's a pro-growth hormone, and pro-growth is not bad if you're, you know, a big bodybuilder guy or you're a growing child, but it's not good in context of, you know, overt cell growth, uncontrolled cell growth, which is, that's cancer. Mm. So the theory is that high protein is a causative agent in cancer. And, you know, that's kicking around. Lots of people, some very impressive science that's done on short-lived rodents. And when you look at the observational data, because we don't have a clinical trial on it, in humans, it's much more it's very inconsistent. Let's put it that way. So, you know, I kind of step back a little bit and I say, like, the rodent data is impressive, and the longevity data, just like, you know, energy caloric restriction, is impressive. The translatability of those observations to the human condition is, in my opinion, anyway, at best shaky. And at worst, it can't translate. And there are lots of other reasons, you know, without going too deep into it, why I kind of squint a little bit and I say, you're going to have to do a little better at convincing me and other people, I think, that higher protein begets shorter lifespan or an increased risk of cancer. And, you know, I've talked about it often enough. There is a set of data that myself and a couple of other people who are much better at doing this have had in review with, I think, enough journals. I can almost call it in press now, but it's been rejected several times, hopefully soon, to sort of push back against that theory. When you do the right, I think, statistics and science, there really is no association between protein and cancer, or even, you know, a cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, those types of things. But
yeah, I mean, I would imagine there are dozens, if not more, confounders to account for in that kind of study. I suppose if I was to randomly select 1,000 people and track them for a year, and assuming they don't have any major socioeconomic things affecting diet, what would a typical person's protein intake be in the absence of forcing it because they've listened to a podcast or read an article, yeah, or whatever? A normal diet giving me?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think most people sort of tend to settle in, and if there's a protein stat sort of theory, and this is the, you know, the Simpson and Rabenheimer protein leverage type hypothesis, at about 16 to 17% of energy coming from protein. And so that more to the point of, you know, if you cover your energy needs, you're probably going to be fine. So if you have elevated energy needs because you're an athlete and you're meeting those energy needs, then protein just tends to be there. Conscious sort of decisions, mine on a day-to-day basis would probably be closer to about 20, maybe 22, something like that. But most people, it's around 15 and 16. And if there's sort of, you know, the wisdom of the crowd type effect, then you could say, well, that must be what people need, or they, you know, wouldn't engage in sort of protein seeking behavior. I just think that that's a lot of, you know, food guide driven, you know, this is the portion of your plate that protein occupies, and this is the portion that starch occupies, and then fruits and vegetables over here. Still, you know, but I think the, I'll call it flexibility of, you know, we have in North America, between Canada and the US, what they call the acceptable macronutrient distribution ranges. And these are really wide, like it's, you know, 10 to 30% from fat, 10 to 35% from protein, and, you know, 25 to 65% from carbohydrates. The devil's obviously in the details. You know, carbohydrates shouldn't be all simple sugars. Fat shouldn't be all saturated fats. And protein shouldn't be all animal source protein versus plant source protein. So within that, there are lots of ways to combine macronutrients and still live, you know, and be very healthy. That's the takeaway message, I think.
I always think in a world where I work with a lot of brands around supplementation, there's a lot of talk about supplementation. I think the number one question I want to ask you, and I don't know whether you can answer it effectively, is given what you've said, that athletes generally take in enough protein, what is the role of protein supplements in strength sports and in endurance sports? I think that's probably, in other words, this business that makes millions of dollars every year in supplements, is it really just good marketing?
yeah, it's a good question. I'm going to change one thing that you said and replace the M for millions with B for billions in terms of the amount of money that they make. So no. But to your point, I think it's a good one. And I mean, supplements, and if they have a place in athletes' diet, it's really that they're convenient. And, you know, it takes away the decision of, you know, I don't have to make, cook, prepare, you know, all I got to do, scoop, shake, drink. And that's a convenience factor. The other point that, you know, to make is that if it's a protein powder, for example, it's just protein. So there is nothing else associated. There's no, if you're a low carb person or you're a low fat person, but it's just giving you isolated protein. And so in certain circumstances, and, you know, we could wander off into the direction of aging and, you know, muscle loss, for example, and talk about protein supplementation. In those circumstances, that might not be a bad way to go. Or for an athlete who's training, you know, X number of miles away from their home or the facility where they can get food, maybe the protein supplementation is a convenience. The necessity of protein supplements or supplements maybe in general is something I might question. I think, you know, the important point to make for your viewers is when we've done we've done several meta-analyses now of, you know, what's the effect of protein in augmenting muscle mass gains. And it's, you know, it pains me to say this after 30 years of doing it. It's really small. Like, I mean, you know, 85 to 90% of the gain is made by just going to the gym. You get another little thin slice on top with protein supplementation, but it's much smaller than people, you know, want to wave the flag, which makes me sort of think, you know, when people ask me questions about timing and what type of supplement and everything, and I'm like, it's just that's in the details. Like, this is the effect, and the effect within the effect is, I mean, you'd need a couple of million people to detect it. So, yeah, that's a confessional thing. You know, after 30 years, I'm like, it's not that big a deal, basically.
I mean, it's a big statement that you're making, because, in effect, you're questioning the validity of a big industry that is very good at marketing itself. Mm-hmm. And it's not, as you say, it's not totally wrong, because there is some evidence of some benefit. But again, sitting there downing a supplement in a normal situation when you're living at home and you've got a normal diet, in short, protein supplements make a very little difference. And that does that apply both to strength athletes and also to endurance athletes?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's some sort of some nuances to take away. I'm no longer an athlete. I freely admit that. I'm just a mere mortal trying to, at this point, everything's on the downslope, right? So I'm trying to, you know, mitigate that, you know, not like this, hopefully like this. You know, I use protein as a supplement in my diet, mainly to control my appetite. I find if I eat that amount of protein, I actually don't get overly hungry. And, you know, we can debate the merits of satiety around protein, but I think it's pretty conclusive that it's the most satiating of all the nutrients. But I also enjoy food. I like bread, I like pasta, and I like rice. So I'm not a low carb person, but I eat a lot less, you know, carbohydrates than I used to. I think from the, you know, the practicality side of the question that you posed, though, and, you know, in fairness, trying to stay on track here, is that it's not that, you know, supplements are useless. It's just that the expectation of what they will deliver in terms of, you know, augmentation of your physique, if you are a bodybuilder or a weightlifter or something like that, is I think has been over exaggerated. And that's a marketing coup over the years. And I think that that's also probably, you could, you know, insert a number of other sports supplements there to say is that it's not going to take you from being, a low responder up to being, you know, the person on the front of the magazine. It might nudge you a little bit, but it's not a transformational, you know, intervention. And I challenge anybody to find me a supplement that would take you and make that leap. I mean, I don't think that there are many out there. Surely, like, if you're up in that level, then you're probably doing everything so, because the margins become quite thin. But for most mere mortals, AKA, you know, like everybody else, right? it's a small thing. So, you know, resistance trained athletes, like the muscle growth, the rate limiting determination of how much muscle you're growing is not, generally speaking, protein. They're getting enough. Endurance athletes, you wonder, but I mean, that enhanced turnover of proteins is a real thing in endurance athletes, not just of muscle, but bone, connective tissues, you know, all of these things that also matter. But, you know, rehydrate, refuel, and then number three is repair. And it's a distant number three, and that's where the protein comes in. And, you know, so long as you're getting enough, then you're not going to notice like, oh, I'm lacking protein in my diet. But if your energy intake is marginal, if your volume of exercise there's been a sudden increase, then, you know, it may be that those protein requirements, you know, transitorily go up and you could benefit. But on balance, yeah, I'm going to say it's a small effect.
Is the same true of, let's say, an endurance athlete who does 4, 5, 6 hours or more, and who consumes a carbohydrate protein mix as opposed to purely carbohydrates during exercise, when the turnover is actually happening?
Yeah, I mean, there's very few studies on the type of duration that you're talking about in the protein carb blends. Most people can't really, some people have a hard time with carbohydrates, but when you get that fixed out and let's say it's 5 to 6%, in a solution, you can probably handle about 1% protein, and athletes can sort of, I think, can teach their gut to handle that. It may be in those situations, because you're adding the substrate during the exercise, that, you know, the post-exercise need to put the protein back into the system is not going to be as big, for sure. I mean, it's all still about, you know, I mean, in a gross sense, protein in, you know, protein out, and 80% of the protein that we excrete in a given day is urinary urea. So if you're putting more in, then you're going to produce more out, but you're also going to provide those bricks at just another time during exercise.
Yeah, and I guess by extension, I suppose you're saying here that people who do that exercise don't need to rush to put it back in when they finish.
Yeah, so like, yeah. Well, you know,
is the sooner the better?
You know, again, this is another one of these, you know, again, 30 years ago, the post-exercise window, which was mainly around restoration of glycogen, you know, as being some sort of critical, you know, the muscle was insulin sensitive post-exercise, and you had to get the carbs into the system. And then I think the science sort of marched on and it said, well, it's not that critical. What you really need is enough carbohydrate within the, say, 24 hours before you're going to train again. Now, if you're doing 2-a-days, maybe it's more critical. Protein's a different animal. It shares a little bit of physiology with carbohydrate, in that the transport into muscles and et cetera is only enhanced when you consume protein. There's no question about that, but it's not something that has, you know, a rate constant of you're immediately anabolically sensitive post-exercise, and then it just flattens out after it stays up for a long period of time. And I saw there's a group, I really need to look the reference up, and they have a great analogy. Instead of saying it's a window, it's more like a garage door or a garage door. You know, it stays open. It's big. You can drive in there just about any time. And there should be no rush. Pragmatically speaking, you guys know as well as I do, as much as we think elite athletes are tuned into exactly what they should be doing, and they all do it, that they don't. So, you know, the shift in North American sports, particularly pro sports, is to try and control the athlete as much as you can. So if they come out, you know, off of the field or off the court or off the ice or whatever, there's a post-exercise fueling station, and it'll contain meals and food with protein. So you could, so these guys, they're kickstarting the recovery process right away.
Yeah, we used to do that when I was with the Sevens, South African Sevens rugby team. Every player got on the bus and there was a water bottle waiting for them with a what was basically a protein hydrolysate mix. And they used to hate the taste. They used to hate the taste of it, but they weren't allowed off the bus until it was finished. So.
Well, that's one way. You know, you've got a captive audience. It's interesting. You spend some time around pro sports and you think, well, they listen to all the good stuff. These guys must do it. And I'm like, you would be, I think, shocked as to how few of them would they be. If you gave them the choice, they'd be like, no, man, I'm not taking that stuff. Forget it, you know?
I'm interested. Have you had any pushback from some of these big companies with some of the statements you've made? Have you had phone calls from the odd company saying, oh, your research is wrong and our research is right?
Well, I've always received pushback even over my entire career. So I think that it's nothing new. But I mean, I think the point is, some people are a little bit dismayed because, and I'll admit that, you know, you probably got it right, is that you listened to me 25, 30 years ago, and I would have given you a different narrative to the one I've given now. Now, fast forward to now, and science marches on, and the answer to the question of what are the benefits of protein, and we've probably, in the Royal We, our lab, have contributed to some of the hype, if you like, of what protein can do for you. When you do the science, and that's what I have to follow now. And, you know, I'm at McMaster University, and we consider ourselves the home of evidence-based medicine, evidence-based practice, whatever you want to call it. And so when you do the evidence-based analysis, the effect is small. So, and when I talk about it now, people are like, but you said, and I'm like, hold on, I'm still a scientist. And so I'm changing my mind. Like, that's the way it is. And then they get pretty upset. And some of the supplement companies, I think, of, you know, I'm no longer on their Christmas card list, but that's okay. That's how science works. I was going to say, I do think as time has marched on, and as I've gotten older, so research becomes me search. I think for people, when they get older, it probably comes around full circle. And now there is a case to be made for, you know, increased protein supplements as people are sort of on that downslope of sarcopenia, muscle loss. So that's been a lot more of my, and their performance goals are not gold medals, but, you know, being able to stay mobile until old age.
I mean, the aging thing is interesting. I know that's a big area of your research now, so I would like to go into that. I was just going to make the comment that I don't think you're helped by the 0.8 grams per kilogram per day recommendation, because I remember talking to people who were in the gyms trying to gain weight, and they mocked how low that was.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't really do any favors when, you know, you're saying like twice that is probably what people need to aim for. The official line is 0.8. Most people know that 0.8 is not enough. And that creates a window of opportunity for a supplement company, because there's a market of people going, that's not enough.
No, spot on. To your point, I mean, I think that's really, you know, and it's honestly, it's a disservice, and people still go back to the science and everything. The methodology is something called nitrogen balance. And let's just say that we know a lot about nitrogen balance and the flaws in the methodology. And yet, the response is, when you talk to the people at the WHO, FAO, and the Institute of Medicine that set this number, they say, well, we've got a lot of data from nitrogen balance. And I'm like, but you've got a lot of data from a flawed method. And yet we cling to this. It's as if somebody chiseled it on a tablet and brought it down from the mount and said, thou shalt not, you know, this is good enough. This is more than enough. And I say, well, what does it mean to be in nitrogen balance? And the answer is, it means you're in nitrogen balance. There is no physiological correlate as to what that means. And so, you know, what's the health outcome on which you should base protein requirements? That's a great question. It won't be solved by me in my lifetime, I can tell you that. But we're trying.
Speaking of lifetimes, aging is a topic. I mean, that is a special population. I thought that the protein requirements were slightly lower as you got older.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, so what happens as you get older is a phenomenon that probably shares some analogies with insulin resistance. It is called anabolic resistance. So the normally anabolic effects of consuming protein, you know, if you get this response as a young person, you get this response as an older person. So the one way to sort of, you know, keep the system as sensitive as possible, just like insulin sensitivity, is to maintain your levels of physical activity. So the more active you are, you're probably, you know, instead of being down here, if you're sedentary, you're somewhere here. I think aging is just eventually it's going to sort of erode that response. It's just the, you know, unfortunately, aging is going to happen. We've not been able to turn the clock back. But, you know, so the other way to compensate for a reduced sensitivity of the response is to feed people more protein and probably proteins that are rich in one single of the building blocks, the BRICS, and that's an amino acid called leucine. And for reasons that we don't fully understand, but it's an evolutionarily conserved system, is that systems respond to leucine per se, which is a branched chain amino acid. And it's essentially like it's kind of like a light switch, but not an on off switch. It's more like one of the dimmer switches. So you can turn the system on with more leucine, and you know, you get to a certain point where you could give it more and more and more leucine or protein, and you just can't make the lights any brighter. So that's something I think that in older people has maybe been underappreciated, if anything, maybe not un, but underappreciated.
Mm. So what are you saying, that supplementation is better for older people, or it's the exercise that's more important? I'm talking about a journalist perspective here.
Sure. You wouldn't get me on here and not go away saying that, you know, exercise is probably king, if that's the right way, or it's the number one thing that everybody should be doing. But then we know how many people do that on a regular basis. The runner-up is clearly nutrition. I think supplementation.
So exercise is the number one way
absolutely.
Of maintaining muscle structure. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, for sure. The more active you are, and the more, you know, even you know, something as simple as going for a walk, right? Because I mean that's gravity is still working on your legs, and you know, we got a horrendous lesson in what being inactive or being on bed rest or sitting around with the pandemic. I mean, it was, we got illustrative examples of people who went through periods of muscle disuse. And those are watershed moments in an older person's life, because instead of going down like this, you all of a sudden have it's a very precipitous drop. And the problem is when you're older, you have those periods is you just can't, like you did when you're young, you can't bounce back. So it's a tough one to get over. So the answer to the question of, you know, are supplements beneficial is they can be in certain situations. I don't know that it's a supplement of sort of branched chains or any, you know, something else like that, but definitely high quality proteins or even leucine per se. The catch 22 is that leucine, if I doubt whether you've done this, but if you taste it, it's the most bitter amino acid you've ever tasted. It's awful.
Yeah, that's
so
why the players
keep sprinkling
hate
it and add it to food. It's not a particularly great taste profile.
Yeah, yeah.
Do we have any research? You mentioned it very briefly around animal protein versus plant based proteins. What is the research telling us about how they're used by the body and the benefits of both?
Yeah, and this is another area again that. Over the time I've been doing this, that my answer to that question has changed. And so, you know, 15, 20 years ago, and it's still fundamentally true, the better quality proteins come from animal sources. So milk, eggs, or dairy, eggs, meat, there's no question about that. They're easier to digest. They have a better essential amino acid profile. So those 9 BRICS that we need, there's more of them in those foods than plant proteins. They have anti-nutritional compounds, things that reduce the digestibility of the protein, and they tend to have less of the essential amino acids. The evidence that's come out now with isolated plant proteins, so now you take proteins from peas, you take proteins from soybeans, you take proteins from, you know, you insert vegetable source here, you've taken out all the anti-nutritional components. You've purified the protein. So that's no longer a concern. And it's really then resting on the essential amino acid content. And when we've fed humans these proteins, we're, you know, my response now is that the difference is pretty marginal. And they're much closer in terms of what they impart from a muscle supportive or a health supportive standpoint than I originally ever thought that they were. And I think that that's now becoming, I mean, it's pretty, you walk into the grocery store now and there are plant-based products that are, you know, definitely much more available than they were a lot, you know, even 5 years ago.
And there's no downside, for instance, I mean, you say they're very close in terms of how they work with the body. There's no downside necessarily of sticking with animal protein or moving across to plant-based protein. Is there any reason to change that?
Not from a human health standpoint, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I think that, you know, what people who are concerned about the quality, you know, sort of issue with plant versus animal source proteins, you really begin to look at then, you know, how much protein are you getting? And if people are getting, you know, around that 1.6, then it's a non-issue. The quality is not a rate limiting. The closer you get to your protein requirements, then protein quality does become an issue. But at the same time, and I can't, you know, I can't give you an intelligent answer to this or an informed answer. People will, who are much smarter than me, will say, well, from an environmental impact standpoint, plant then is the choice that you should make. And then I go, well, okay, I'm going to have to take your word for it, because those calculations seem to me to be based on a number of assumptions that I don't understand the basis of them. But maybe that's the argument that a lot of people who are plant-based, if that's the right way to say it, would give you.
Mm. What about the other end of the spectrum from aging in kids, and particularly teenagers? Do the requirements go up, or is 1.6 enough for them also?
Oh, it's more than enough. I mean, the luxury of being a kid is you're under the influence of lots of hormones that are promoting growth. And so it seems like just about anything you put in your body is directed towards the growth process. And, you know, being the father of three young, well, they're all young men now, and watching the amount of food that they can eat, it's insane. So they I mean, they're expending a lot of energy. They're all still active, playing sports, et cetera. But they also are going through this, you know, growth spurt period of their lives. And that's more than enough. It's not a population that I worry about where protein is a rate limiting substrate. Definitely. Food insecure regions, people on marginal protein intakes. Definitely. It's an entirely different question. But most kids are, you know, again, covering energy needs, all good.
Mm. By way of almost, we want to move towards wrapping up. I mean, it's been fascinating and eminently practical, I think. How has the field changed? You said 25, 30 years worth. Now you've got social media. So everyone who eats food is an expert in food.
Sure, of course, yeah.
You must spend a great deal of your time refuting the BS you spoke of earlier. Where do you reckon we are in 10 years from now? Do you think the circle turns back towards carbs? Does it eventually find balance and common sense? Heaven forbid we get to that point.
Well, balance and common sense would be great. My feeling is that what we're beginning to discover in a lot of these trials is, and people seem amazed by inter-individual variability. And, you know, so we take 100 people, we put them all on an exercise bike, 20 people out of the 100 get a massive change in VO2 peak, 40 people get a sort of a mediocre change, another 40 get nothing, they don't change at all. And, you know, a small group, for some bizarre reason, actually go in the opposite direction, or, you know, like, what's happening there? And people are like, well, exercise is good for you. And the fundamental answer is, of course it is. But for some people, it doesn't have all the beneficial effects that we think. And the question is why. So this is, you know, enter the theater of multi-omic technologies and looking at genes, but not just genes that you have, how they're expressed, you know, what proteins are expressed, what metabolites result. And so the metabolome, the proteome, the transcriptome, the genome, the, you know, insert your whatever level of control, ome, the microbiome, as an example. The confluence of all of these, you know, massive volumes of data is, I think, going to sort of move us towards the hypothetical personalized type nutrition, if you like, whether it's as specific as people think that we'll be able to nail down exact nutrient intakes, I don't think so. It's probably, and without being overly jaded on the ability of, as Mike Joyner calls it, moonshot medicine, to sort of predict exactly who you're going to be, that fundamental truisms are out there, is that, you know, eat a varied diet, plant protein is okay, you know, animal protein, like I'm an omnivore, so unashamedly omnivorous, that you can probably glaze over a lot of specific recommendations. Again, I hate to say this, if you're physically active, it's the forgiver of many sins. So I'm counting on that right now. I enjoy what I eat. And I think that that's one thing that we've removed when we talk about, you know, trying to get your precision nutrition signature is, you know, the enjoyment of a meal and sitting down with your friends and, you know, maybe having a glass of wine or a beer or something like that is maybe being lost. And that's unfortunate, because, you know, that to me is that's a big part of what it takes to age well as well. It's not just exercise, not just nutrition, but there's a big part of social that's involved there. But precision medicine, precision nutrition, whatever you want to call it, marches on. And I don't think we're going to get away from that anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm thinking of this conversation now, it seems to me, if I was to give a listener one recommendation or assurance, it's that as long as you're sensible, you're pretty much likely to be okay. Like, there'll be people who started off listening to this thinking, should I change my diet? Do I need more protein in my diet and so on? It sounds to me like the answer 99 out of 100 times is no, unless there's something clearly that you're doing that's unusual in your diet. Sensible equals fine.
Yeah, sense is, you know, sometimes in short supply. I think that there's a tendency for the people out on social media, you know, you've got to distinguish yourself from the masses. And if the masses are saying, you know, this is sort of the, you know, varied mixed diet, and people go, oh, you know, that we did that for 20 years. And the answer is, we talked about it, but very few did it. And, you know, the battleground, if you want to draw one, is not carbs versus fats or proteins. It's, you know, real whole foods versus contrived processed foods. And I think that that's a battle worth fighting for sure. But there's no monopoly on common sense. And so social media people need to have a shtick to, you know, to create something that is different and distinguishes them from just the mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's always this belief to some extent when we talk about, I mean, things that people always say, if you're a vegetarian, for instance, you are going to be short of protein. Is that something that you've done any sort of research into vegetarians, for instance? Because obviously in sport, there's a big move towards vegetarianism in sport.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, I mean, it's the usual suspects with vegetarian diets are, you're going to be deficient in iron because you don't have animal source protein, usually for meat. You might be deficient in zinc, and you're going to be low in protein. And the short answer is that, when, you know, just like omnivorous eating athletes or omnivores, vegetarians, you could be a good vegetarian. In other words, you're pretty judicious about how you pick your food. Or you can be a crappy vegetarian. You know, if you drink a Diet Coke and eat a slice of bread or a slice of toast with butter on it, you're still a vegan vegetarian. But it's not a great fueling strategy if you're running, you know, 100 miles a week. So chances are is that, you know, these vegan vegetarian athletes have thought and are conscientious about what they eat. Some are not. But then the same is true of omnivorous athletes as well. So on balance, if you ask me, no, vegan or vegetarian athletes are not deficient in. Are some? Absolutely. But the same is true of omnivores.
You know, in a world full of misinformation and nonsense about this sort of stuff, someone listening to this says, right, I'm all on board with common sense. I'm going to do what I've been doing with confidence now. But I do want to know more detail. Aside from reading academic papers, where in your experience have you found to be the best places to go to learn more about this?
Yeah, social media, and you know, I don't need to tell you, can be great. And at the same time, it can be awful. There are some people that I think that are on social media that are worth a follow because what they say is good information. And you can learn. I think that there's an unprecedented time now where you can seek out resources and probably find people who are giving. The hard part is deciphering finding the signal in the noise. It's becoming infinitely more challenging when, you know, when I started grad school, I would read 5 different journals, and that's where I got 80%+ of my information. Now that's closer to, well, I would say it's not even 25, like more like 50 journals. So a tenfold increase in 25 years. And I have to rely on students to, you know, find papers for me to say, did you see this? Did you see this? And I'm, because there's no way I can keep up. So even in my own field, it's becoming much more challenging. So, you know, from the real world perspective, really tough to do. But yeah, there are a few folks out there that I think give good information. It's just about finding them.
Yeah, you can start, listeners, by going to Twitter and looking up MackinProf. That's
MackinProf. Yeah.
MackinProf. Prof. And that is, of course, Stuart Sandel. So
yeah, you got
start there and then look who Stuart follows, and you'll know who the good ones are.
Yeah, right. Fair enough.
So, Phelps, thanks very much for your time. It's been fascinating just talking to you about something that I think for many people is a very confusing area of their sports nutrition. I think it's been some very practical advice you've given us today. So thank you very much for that.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport Podcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.